Welcome, everyone. Calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 3:04 p.m. Thursday, February 2nd in the House Judiciary Room. The name for the Venerable Max Gruenberg. Will the Secretary please take the roll?
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Josephson? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Chair Chris Tompkins?
Here. And with six members present, we have a quorum. And we have two items on the agenda today. And as a quick reminder to please sound cell phones, and I guess another sort of order of business to touch on, we'll have the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee succeed this committee circa 4:30 p.m. We'll aim to wrap this committee up a little bit before that, or perhaps even faster than that, depending on our speed. And the two bills we have on the agenda today are House Bill 31, relating to the sexual assault examination kits, as well as House Bill 7, the ballot selfie bill, and we'll go in that order. I should also note that House Bill 82, relating to off-highway driver's licenses, was noticed for today, but there's further dialogue occurring with the Department of Motor Vehicles, so that we will hold off on today pending more conversation. So I would like to start with House Bill 31 relating to sexual assault examination kits. And is actually maybe what I'll do, because where we left off, Representative Birch, you were dialoguing with a representative from Standing Together Against Rape. That said, I don't see any, and I left public testimony open, but I don't see any public testimony or a representative from STAR available or online, and I'm looking in the back of the room and I'm seeing a shaking of the head. Representative Birch, any comments or questions maybe relating to that?
I think it related to ownership of the kits after they're, you know, if you have a situation where a kit is used and samples taken and it's captured, and there was some discussion about if the victim does not level a charge, is who owns the kit? Is it kept? Is it or is it? And I think some of the follow-on conversation related to victims of domestic violence who often recant a complaint and it only will be repeated again. I was just more or less trying to understand kind of the chain of custody and how that exists as a data point in the case of somebody, you know, if the state's attempting to advance a prosecution, for instance. And it's more of a, I guess it's kind of a technical question, of, you know, what, because you're talking about the backlog here, and I guess my question was, if you take a kit, is it, are they always backlogged, or they can the victim, you know, choose to have that just kind of, you know, put in the back room and never to be seen again, or does the state own it?
And Representative Birch, would it help maybe to have a presenter speak to that point, if only to put it on the record?
Certainly, and again, it kind of relates, I guess, more or less to, you know, kind of a technical aspect of how that DNA track or information may be used successfully in the prosecution of a serial criminal.
And Celeste, are you available to speak to that point? And please identify yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you. My name is Celeste Novak. I'm staff for Representative Tarr. Let me get this correct. Through the chair, Representative Birch, thank you. The question about the kits, once they get to the crime lab, in speaking with Orrin Dunn, they are kept in the crime lab in perpetuity, and I think part of the reason is the hope that you stated, even if the victim chooses not to pursue the case, that the DNA evidence is kept on hand, should it need to be utilized in a case such as the one you suggested, perhaps a serial
follow-up?
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's helpful. And I guess, kind of as a follow-up, is if there's no pressing, immediately pressing prosecution, witness recants, are those kits then, you know, is that one of the reasons you might have a backlog of kits that are untested, I guess is a question.
Correct. Although they did state that the crime lab currently is able to keep up with the requests, and they are anticipating a fiscal note, just because there may be an uptick in the kits submitted if this bill should pass. So they state that the crime lab is currently keeping up with the kits sent in.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
And a quick note, Representative Ledoux joined us at 3:06 p.m. Representative Knopf, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. So I'm not exactly clear in my mind yet. So as far as the transaction of the kit, so a kit is utilized, and then it goes to the crime lab. And so under the old school, they stay there because we haven't been processing them if we have a backlog. So they're stored there until they're ready for processing. At that time, we ship them out of state to be processed. I mean, some kits, I think that's currently the practice, if I understood that right. That's what I believe I heard at the last meeting, that logbook kits are processed out of state. And so my question would go then, are they kept at that particular lab where they're processed, or are they shipped back again? Misunderstood that, but I thought that's what I heard.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Knapp. My understanding is that our crime lab is who is processing those kits, and they are not going out of state.
Okay, maybe we can find that out
maybe
for sure.
Maybe clarify that.
Yeah, thank you.
And Representative Knapp, if I'm remembering right from the previous committee hearing, there may be two different processes. Again, I might be misunderstanding it, but one relating to potential imminent federal grant funding to clear out the backlog, and then maybe the other process at hand is to make sure that the backlog, there isn't a new backlog that accumulates in the future. And Ms. Novak, is that ringing a bell, or am I kind of getting that right?
Yes, if I may. And I did respond with hopefully an email that you were all able to receive on the questions in the past, but the outsourcing of some kits go out of state because of the type of processing they are done, but for our in-state requirements, they are processed here at the crime lab in the state of Alaska, and they are kept there in perpetuity.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've been thinking about this and done a little bit of research, and what I didn't understand entirely is if the backlog of cases the backlog of untested kits is due to the fact that they aren't needed for prosecution, or for being charged, whatever it might be, that those ones that are untested are untested for other reasons, not just because they can't get to them. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know that they are not, they have a backlog currently. My understanding is they are caught up on all kits to be processed. So the ones that were backlogged were addressed through that federal funding that came through to the state of Alaska.
The chair. I'm just referring to something was February 1st from the Alaska Public Media article, and it says that at the end of 2016 they had 59 more backlog kits to process, and so I was just wondering what the makeup of that was. That was one question.
Okay. Through the chair, Rep. Johnson. My understanding is the crime lab has 102 kits on hand. 35 are in process being worked on now. So 2 from October of 2016, 25 from November, 34 from December, and 41 from January. And again, Mr. Dim suggested that they are able to maintain progress on those kits.
And if I may interject, is there anyone from the department? I don't see anyone from the department, but I just want to ask and look at our recording secretary. Representative, maybe one last question. We can take it at ease and maybe see if we can get someone from the department also.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Okay. I'm going to call a brief at ease, and we can maybe see if we can get additional resources at hand. Okay, coming back on the record, and I think what we're going to do is set aside House Bill 31, the sexual assault examination kits legislation for now until we can muster more resources and expertise to address a few of the questions at hand. And in the interim, we can move on to the other piece of legislation that we heard on Tuesday, House Bill 7, the ballot selfie bill. And we had a number of questions, I think, go out to committee members by email, and wanted to call up the presenter to see if there are more questions from the committee. Are there any questions from the committee?
Sure, I have a question.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. This is adding statute to make a prohibited activity legal. Is that correct? Am I understanding that? I mean, why wouldn't you remove the statute that you've deemed obsolete? In other words, instead of adding a statute, couldn't you remove the statute that is outdated through now our means of self-expression through selfies?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, this is Reed Magdan, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. The main reason for drafting the way we did is the bill maintains the prohibition on sharing your ballot itself, so taking the physical ballot that you marked and showing that to other people, that prohibition remains. We are merely allowing you to take a photo, video, or other image of that ballot, and that is allowable to share.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the original statute says you can't have a physical ballot to share. Does it also say you can't have a photo image? And is that what your this other one, this House Bill 7, is trying to allow sharing photo images? So the original statute, does it also include photo images?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, Reed Magdans again. Yes, the current statute has been interpreted to include images of your ballot. To read from it, the current wording is subject to AS 1515-240. A voter may not exhibit the voter's ballot to an election official or any other person so as to enable any person to ascertain how the voter marked the ballot. It's been interpreted that means sharing the physical ballot or sharing a photo of it.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the original statute says you can't share your ballot, and it's been interpreted to include photos. So you want to remove the photo image part, but still sharing the physical ballot is still against the law. But you're differentiating one from the other, even though by interpretation you're saying they're the same thing, that they could be interpreted to be the same thing. So I get what you're saying. I'm just trying to understand. If they're interpreted to be the same thing, yet you're going to differentiate it with two different statutes, that one is okay and one... Anyhow, you see what I'm trying to... see what I'm asking?
I'll give it a shot, Representative Wohl, through the chair. This is Reed again. And if we're going to get into the details of how the current statute is interpreted, I'd probably turn to the director of the Division of Elections or Libby Bacalar, who are both here and would be better suited to answer those. But what I will say to you at this moment, Representative Wohl, is that we, in drafting the bill, did not have any intention of allowing people to take their physical ballot and share it with others. We were mainly interested, and the bill reflects that, we were mainly interested in allowing the sharing of photos, videos, or images of the ballot.
Okay. And Representative Wohl, would from the Department of Law or Ms. Binky be...
Let me ask one last question, and thank you, Mr. Chair, through the Chair. You say it's interpreted that the original statute has been interpreted to include photo images. Has that been case-tested, or is that just if you ask somebody? Is that in Alaska? I know there was one case in Colorado. I don't know if there's any others in the country, but... You know, as that's not determined by a judge, or is that just asking someone in Department of Law?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, I'm going to have to call my lifeline on that one.
Ms. Bacalar, are you available?
I am. Thank you, Chair. For the record, Libby Bacalar from the Department of Law. I'm here to answer questions at the request of the chair. I'm sorry, the sponsor.
Representative Wohl. Same question.
I'm trying to remember the question now.
I think it was how the current statute is interpreted.
Interpreted, yeah. In other words, if the current statute is interpreted to include physical ballot and a photo image of a ballot, and that this new statute is to say that the photo image is okay, but the physical ballot is not okay to display, does that mean you're going to reinterpret the initial statute to remove photo images?
And
has it been case tested?
It has not been case tested in Alaska, through the chair. I'm sorry, Representative Wohl. It has not been case tested here. This statute was enacted in 1960 along with the prohibition on political persuasion at the polls. And I believe they were enacted sort of in companion with each other, and that the original purpose of the 1960 statute was to ensure that no one sort of waved their ballot around to show it how to, you know, try to encourage anybody to vote in a particular way. Every election, the Division of Elections receives a number of phone calls from voters asking about ballot selfies and if they're going to be prosecuted and so forth. There is a whole separate chapter of the Election Code, 1556, that deals with election crimes. The remedy for it violating this statute as it currently exists is essentially spoiling of the ballot. As it says in 1515, 1515-300, prohibiting the count of exhibited ballots. That's essentially the penalty for exhibiting the ballot under the 1960 statute. This amendment seeks to, I believe, catch up with technology. I don't think anybody in the 1960 legislature could ever have anticipated selfies. We do get calls about that every election. It has been case tested in New Hampshire. I believe the First Circuit Court of Appeals held that a statute that did the reverse of this, that essentially actively prohibited a ballot selfie, was unconstitutional under the First Amendment. In terms of how we've interpreted this over the years, there's, to my knowledge, never been any prosecution or any even civil remedy imposed for exhibiting a ballot. What we say to voters when they call on election day and say, is this okay? Am I going to be prosecuted? You know, we say, you know, the statute says what it says, but it's a bit of an apples and oranges, because clearly the statute was never meant to encompass photography, because there was no portable photography at that time. It was meant to prohibit electioneering. So that was a long answer to your question, but hopefully that helped.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also understand that it wasn't just for electioneering, but it's also for vote buying.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I believe that's correct. Essentially, I haven't gone back to the legislative history in the 1960 enactment, but I believe the main purpose of it, right, was to avoid essentially true malfeasance at the polls intended to impact the outcome of the election in some way. The modern iteration of the ballot selfie is to sort of, you know, the way I've seen it is to celebrate the act of having voted, that kind of thing, not necessarily to try to persuade anybody to vote in any particular way. It's just sort of a new, uncharted territory we're in terms of where the law is. So yes, I think the concern at that time was vote buying, electioneering, and all of the other things that sort of also the voter misconduct statutes are meant to go to.
Representative Liddell?
I've got a couple of questions. So when the law was passed in 1960, how much absentee voting was there?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I could go back and look and see. I don't have an answer to that off the top of my head, but if you give me about 1 second here, I can probably find when the absentee ballot statute was enacted. But I think it was after that. I mean, 1960 was the first legislature after statehood, so I assume absentee ballots happened after that. But I can double-check while you're thinking of the next question.
Well, actually, I sort of have the next question.
Okay.
I mean, I'm wondering whether this whole statute makes any sense. I mean, clearly, this cannot be enforced at all with respect to absentee voting. I mean, unless you have an election official sleeping in everybody's house.
Well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that the statute that's being amended actually appears in the part of the code that deals with conduct in the polling place. So I think read in whole, in the context of the rest of the statutes, it goes to conduct at the polling place. But I don't think that the drafters in that legislature necessarily had in mind absentee voting. It's in the context of polling place conduct that this statute appears.
Follow up?
Yeah, and yet, actually, if you were concerned about vote buying, I would think that would probably more likely appear in the context of an absentee vote. So, I mean, I'm not really sure this whole statute makes any sense to me.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I'm just looking at the absentee voting statute. This is what's called a no-cause or a no-fault absentee vote statute, and it does appear that we have had this statute since 1960. So 1520.010, at any election, a qualified voter may vote an absentee ballot for any reason, was initially enacted, Chapter 4.01, sorry, Section 4.01, Chapter 83, Session Laws of Alaska in 1960. So they were enacted simultaneously, in fact.
So it's not illegal to show your absentee ballot to the world, but it is illegal to show your ballot to somebody I can get that you shouldn't be waving it around in the polling place, but, you know, you might have a relative with you, and the relative might be, you know, asking, hey, how should I vote? And you might want to show this to them. So it sounds like under this bill, you can't show them the ballot, but you can take a picture of the ballot and show them the picture. And so if you're going to do that, I'm just wondering whether it makes any sense to just have the law, period.
Representative Ledoux,
that's just a rhetorical question.
Oh, okay. Well, then I won't answer it.
I'm interested in the answer.
Okay. Chairman Christ Tompkins, I think that the issue here is one of intent and of state of mind. The evil, if you will, that the exhibition prohibition is designed to prevent is, as Representative Tuck said, vote buying and also influencing the outcome of the election. So I think, you know, whether it was an absentee ballot or in a polling place ballot, there is no, without that intent to persuade someone else to vote in a particular way, you don't have a violation or a problem. And you're right, I don't think there's any way to control every single thing that happens, when somebody has an absentee ballot. There's all sorts of security measures and other things the division does in processing absentee voting, and that's obviously a whole other topic. But I think that the exhibition statute is meant to discourage polling place pressure on voters.
Any follow-up, Representative Ledoux?
No, that's okay.
Your rhetorical question was successfully answered. Any other questions? Representative Birch.
Yeah, just thank you, Chair. It strikes me that you know, if we've never prosecuted anybody, it hasn't really come up as an issue that, you know, maybe it's better to let sleeping dogs lie. And I'm just, to my friend from Fairbanks, you know, I mean, people are going to do it. It's a different day. I mean, from as discussed with their absentee ballots, and if the Department of Law has never really seen the need to prosecute anybody, and I could understand if they're waving it outside the voting booth or trying to transmit the information to somebody, and you know, that's soon to be voting. But it seems like it's more often than not, it's, you know, somebody's written their name in for president or something, and you know, it's kind of sharing that or something kind of non-specific to a voting persuasion, if you will.
Well, Representative Bush, through the chair, I think the reason to clarify this issue is just simply one of voter confusion and clarity. As I mentioned before, every election, the Division of Elections and the Department of Law both, do field a substantial number of phone calls from people asking about the legality of ballot selfies, and under the laws technically drafted, it's hard to know what to say to that. I mean, clearly in 1960 there was no such thing. I think the intent of the law is meant to address that confusion and tell voters that as long as they're not trying to politically persuade anybody at the polls, that it's okay to take a ballot selfie and share that with their friends or on social media or what have you. It's simply a vote. I think it's a voter confusion issue more than anything. So I think the sponsors could speak better to that. I'm certainly not trying to promote the legislation. I'm just saying that from the division's perspective, it does cause voter confusion. And I've seen that myself in my capacity as the attorney for the division.
Thank you.
Representative Knott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm not asking for a legal opinion. I'm asking for a personal opinion as an individual who's probably read the entire statute section, and I have not. I only read the bills and the amendments. So would it, going to Representative Ledoux's question, would it in fact be cleaner to repeal the existing statute than to modify and amend as HB 7 is proposing? In your opinion, would it be cleaner?
Representative Knott, through the chair, I don't know that it necessarily would be cleaner, again, for the reason that I think the policy behind the initial statute is still retained in the current political and technological climate that we live in. We don't want to encourage, obviously, we still have the 200-foot rule about political persuasion near the polls. We don't want that. We don't want any sort of pressuring of anybody. So I do think the original policy behind it is still very much, probably, I would think, an important policy. So I don't know that doing away with that altogether is necessarily any wiser than making an amendment that specifically exempts this particular conduct.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hate to beat this issue into the ground. It sounds like that there's some good stuff in the original bill. Maybe today's world, it's obsolete. It also sounds like people have heard, it's kind of like drawing on money. If you deface money, it's illegal, but people do it. But people aren't really calling saying, hey, I have a dollar bill with some ink on it, can I use it? They don't ask that question, but obviously they're still asking this other question. So if this amendment is passed, then when they call you, you can definitively say, no, it is not illegal, where in the past you'd have to say, well, and this is sort of a legal out for the Department of Law. Is that correct?
Representative, well, that is correct, and also for the Division of Elections and for voters in general. There have been a lot of high-profile ballot selfie cases, specifically in states where there's an active prohibition, which we don't really have. We have a statute that was enacted at a time when that didn't exist, so it's hard to say that the 1960 legislature had this in mind, but there are states who have enacted ballot selfie prohibitions, and I think it was Justin Timberlake or something that was famously in trouble for doing, you know, showing his ballot. So in any event, I think it's just a voter confusion issue. It certainly would help the division on election day to be able to definitively tell voters that this conduct is permitted in statute, because it is being done, as you say, and so to be able to give them that assurance without saying, well, you know, I can't really say one way or the other. So so does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes,
okay, thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's just a statement, but what we're trying to do right here is we're trying to balance electioneering with First Amendment rights. And my, one of the concerns I have is the undue influence or the vote bullying. And so as we look at this, I would like to see some sort of provisions that still protects vote bullying, even in your own home. So rather than making it to where the person who's filling out the ballot is restricted, more so that the person trying to do the bullying is restricted from doing that, so it's some sort of consequence for someone trying to bully. Also concerned about people taking photographs with other voters behind them in polling locations too. So just a whole general concern about voting in the areas of your polling locations. I think if we're going to allow selfies to be done, I think it's got to be restricted right in that booth and no other photographs in those areas, because I don't know if it's a freedom of speech right to be able to photograph people going in and out of ballots or in and out of polling places either. So I think some of the same restrictions that we have of 200 feet within a polling place, those restrictions should remain until they get in the voting booth, and then if they can, because they're enclosed, so they're not taking photographs of anybody else. So I would like to see some sort of limitation in regards to when, where, and how you photograph.
And,
thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Tuck, that sounds like a quintessentially perfect segue to an amendment that may be on the table. Representative Knopp, do you have an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move amendment number one.
And I'm going to object for purposes of discussion.
And Representative Knopp, is it okay if Ms. Norton speaks the amendment that you generously offered?
Be preferred.
Can we state the version to make sure I have? I want to make sure I have the amendment that he's introducing, the same version. That
yeah, absolutely. And for Representative Knopp, would you
read it off so I
read the work number?
This is version 30-LS0111/A-8.2.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we all on the same literal page here? Ms. Norton, would you be able to speak to this amendment?
To the chair, yes. And Alicia Norton, intern for Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins. So as we've been discussing, we, the office, have been working with the Division of Elections to draft language to address physically showing a photo of a ballot or a photo of a ballot selfie within the polling place or within 200 feet of the polling place. And we aim to prohibit physically displaying a photo, video, or other image of the person's marked ballot in an attempt to persuade a person to vote for or against a candidate, proposition, or question.
Any questions from the committee on amendment number one? Do you hold your objection, Representative?
No,
Radio?
I remove my objection.
I'm going to object just so I can take
sure.
Make sure it's covering everything that I'm hoping that it covers.
Yeah, Representative Search.
Yeah, when it says physically display a photo, is that as in send it to someone or share it?
Ms. Norton?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, it means physically displaying as in having a phone and directly putting it in someone's face.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So speaking to the amendment, it doesn't address what I brought up earlier, but I do think it's an important amendment because it is making sure that there's no electioneering happening outside of the person taking the picture within the voting booth as they're exiting their polling location, and only until they after they leave their polling location can they then display that. But I do want to bring up the concern of having photographs taken within that 200 that 200 foot perimeter before someone goes into that voting booth, so and or leaving that voting booth. So I do want to address that at some time, but I will remove my objection to amendment number one.
All right. Is there any further objection to amendment number one?
I have no objection to amendment number one, but if I could have permission to dialogue with Representative Tuck.
Yes, and the second representative will do. Just for the record, hearing no further objection, amendment number one passes. And Representative Ledoux, please dialogue with Representative Tuck.
In the Greenberg Room.
In the Greenberg Room.
So what is the problem with photographing somebody going in and out of the ballot, of the polls?
And if I may, Mr. Chair, through the chair, it's going back to vote buying, making sure that, you know, a person has a right to vote, but a person also has a right to refrain from voting. And I'm just worried about that undue pressure that was originally put in this for vote buying and requiring people to vote when they have a right not to vote. So, and I just think it just continues the I think people are going to feel uncomfortable going in voting, knowing that people are photographing them when they're going in and voting. I don't want to deter people from going into the voting booth, nor do I want to be in my voting booth and see a selfie stick coming over the top as I'm voting. So I think there needs to be limitations on when and how you take those photographs if we're going to allow this First Amendment right to be allowed. It just, I think there needs to be some sidebars put on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So please. I actually have a follow-up, not with Representative Tuck, but I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name here.
Libby Bacalar.
Bacalar?
Bacalar, yes.
Yes. So people can determine candidates, parties, etc., under our current voting rules, who's voted and who has not voted. Is that correct? You're allowed to have somebody, a poll watcher at the polls, who can kind of go down and look and see who's voted, and then with the idea that you get your people out who may have not voted?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
And Representative Tuck, just because I think this might be continuing the same thread of thought.
If I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. Is it any public member can go up and grab that, or does someone have to go through some training before they're allowed to take a look at those roles?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, and I think Division Director Banky might be able to speak more precisely to this, but my understanding is that when the polling place is open, there's an election board there that is trained to maintain control of the polling place, proper custody of the ballots, and there are poll watchers who are assigned by parties and candidates who may stay in the polls and remain within earshot of the poll workers, ask for names to be read, look at the precinct register. Precinct registers are also a public record. The way a person votes, of course, is constitutionally protected, but the fact that a person voted in a given election is a public record.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the issue I have is that those poll watchers have to go through training, and there's do's and don'ts that go along with that. When you have a polling location that's now closed and polling's done, yes, that does become public record. I'm just not comfortable with people being able to take photographs with people going in and out of polling locations during polling hours that are not trained, that are not knows the do's and don'ts, and maybe an intimidating factor from people turning out to the polls. So that's just me personally. I think that we should have some sidebars on when and how you take those selfies.
In a clarifying question for me, when you say photographs of people coming in and out of the polls, you're not talking about a photograph of a ballot in the ballot booth, but you're talking about waiting in line, taking photos of people who are waiting to cast the ballot?
Yeah, I grab my phone and I got Chris Burge, I know he's over there somewhere, and I take a selfie, and I include him in that selfie. as a document, as a record.
And just to follow this thread of thought, Ms. Bacalar, I'm about to ask you a question. Is this scenario, as described by Representative Tuck, currently legal or illegal?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I don't believe there are any, again, I don't have every statute memorized, I don't believe there's any photography prohibitions, you know, on going in and out of the polling place. I mean, there's press that come and take pictures. You see in the Alaska Dispatch News pictures of Election Day. I don't know that consistent with the First Amendment such a restriction could actually fly. It would have to depend on how it was drafted, that kind of thing. But it's not illegal currently to take photographs in the polling place. I mean, there's media in there and stuff like that every Election Day. So
I was going to help you with that. You aren't going to keep the local news station out of the polling booth. You're not going to keep cameras out of the polling. I mean, out of your personal space in the polling booth, that's fine. That's sacrosanct. But as far as, you know, trying to prohibit, you know, any cameras or public engagement or public involvement or, gosh, there's Gabrielle. Looks like she's voting today. That's public information. It's the media's, I can say, I think all of us have probably been filmed walking into our respective polling booths at one time or another. And so, I don't think it's particularly a challenge or an issue.
Representative Knopf, did you have a question?
More of a comment, a little dialogue.
Please,
Mr.
go
Chair.
Ahead.
So, you know, there is no perfect legislation, and if we're ever going to move anything, we can't go through life saying, what if, what if, what if. And you know, there will always be a scenario. So, but in that sense, as you mentioned, right now, you can do the photo shoot. You can't do it if a guy's displaying his ballot. You know, you're more apt to have a guy stick his head in alongside you than you are to put a selfie stick over the top of your voting booth. So, in that, I see no problems in the bill and in the amendments. And specifically, I think the amendments actually do a little bit more in Representative Tuck's situation, where it talks about the prohibition of political persuasion or bullying. So, I think it prohibits that, and that could probably be defined better, but I mean, I think it's broad. I think it opens it up, you know. And then there is a little broader definition that says physically display a photo, video, other images of the person's marked ballot. I mean, it specifically says ballot, but there is no prohibition against photos now. So I think the bill's good. I think the amendments are good. And Mr. Chair, I think we should move it.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Point of order?
Yes, please, Representative.
We did adopt Amendment Number 1. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Sounds good. So we're in a discussion of the final passage of the bill?
Yeah, the bill as a whole now.
Okay.
Which,
and then,
of course, includes the amendment.
Okay, thank you. And then I want to make another additional comment when I'm in the roster.
Sure. Representative Ledoux.
And I just have one more question for Ms. Bacalar, and then I'll give up on this line of questioning. What kind of training are poll watchers given?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, and I believe Director Banky might be better equipped to answer this question. I know there is a poll watcher's handbook that they are, if not required, instructed to read. I don't know that there is formal poll watcher training conducted by the state. It may be conducted by the parties who appoint the poll watchers. There is certainly training for poll workers. As for the candidates' poll watchers, I don't know for... No, there's no training for poll watchers that other than the handbook.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Ledoux? And it looks like we've exhausted this side of the room. Representative Tuck, further question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's appropriate to ask what if, what if, what if. I don't mean to frustrate my fellow colleague over to my right. And I'm not trying to hold up a bill, and I think this has been very good dialogue. One of the things I will still be concerned about, and I'm glad we had this dialogue because you're right, I never thought about it before, but a person can go around photographing in and out. But one of the things that I think we may want to do is just making sure that we're limiting
a person's photograph of their ballot to their own ballot and not somebody else's ballot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Beckler, any comment, Representative Tuck's comment that you might feel compelled to make?
And if I may, before she answers that, Mr. Chair.
Please.
It does say right here, image of the person's marked ballot in attempt to persuade a person to vote for or against a candidate proposing or question. So I just want to make sure that the persons in the possessive is the individual person's ballot, not some other person's ballot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that's what I was thinking as you were asking the question. That's how I read this amendment. Maybe it can be tinkered with to make that more clear, but I did read that as referring to the person who is taking the picture of their own ballot.
And Ms. Beckler, would the amendment now, the piece of legislation as amended, be more clear in your legal mind if the word persons, possessive, on line 12 of amendment A.2 were instead voters, possessive?
I think so. I'm sorry, Children Christ Tompkins, yes, I do think that would make it even more clear.
And for the record, Representative Tucker, I guess as a sponsor, I think that would be a welcome and friendly amendment and perhaps enhance the clarity of this legislation.
And if you may, Mr. Chair, would you please repeat that one more time for me?
Yeah, on line 12 of the amendment, of course the amendment's now a piece of the legislation, but on line 12 of the amendment, A.2, the last word of line 12 is persons, possessive, and I was asking Ms. Bacalar if the language might be more clear if it, instead of persons it was voters. So it'd be the voters, as in to give clarity to whose ballot may physically be displayed by photo, video, or other image.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, rather than offering that amendment, I think that this is going on, and we can make that change down the road if necessary, but I do feel comfortable now looking at this a little bit closer that it's a person's possessive ballot to mean a person who marked the ballot. So I'm comfortable with it, but if there's a desire to change that down the road, we can look at that.
Well, we are absolutely honoring the namesake of this room right now. Union perfection. This is good, and I'm very excited to work with you, Representative Tuck, in the next committee referral to make this change towards greater clarity. And with this, I would like to open public testimony because we do have one person waiting online. Tara Rich, if you're online, could you introduce yourself and state your affiliation for the record and present your testimony?
Hi, good afternoon, Chairperson Christ Tompkins. This is Tara Rich, and I'm calling in from the ACLU of Alaska. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share the testimony of the ACLU. I'm going to be brief. There's been a lot of testimony about this today. I'd like to just go through a few questions that I have heard come up, and I'd be happy to share a little bit of our knowledge about the First Amendment and sort of the history of these provisions. These provisions were part of what are called Australian ballot reforms that took place in the late 1800s, around 1890s, as a result of widespread sort of election problems going on in the United States. And I believe Alaska sort of adopted them wholesale, just like every other state had done, in response to what used to be the problem of political parties identifying particular ballots by bright, flamboyant colors, distinctive designs, emblems, so essentially you'd be able to see who was voting for whom, and as a result you could persuade someone or buy someone's vote in order to make sure that they were voting for the right person. So in response to that, there were these ballot laws that outlawed displaying your ballot, and essentially that in America is what allows us to have a secret ballot. So these have been enacted in every state. The problem has become that as technology has advanced, these laws were sort of broadly worded at the time that you shall not display your ballot. And if you think about modern technology as applied to displaying of one's ballot, it became a bit of a blunt instrument. One court described it, quoting the Supreme Court, that using these laws to prohibit photographing one's ballot is like burning down the house to roast the pig. So it's to prevent vote buying, but in effect, it really doesn't have that consequence. So this has been challenged in 5 states. So I just wanted to weigh in on the question of, do we really even need this amendment? Can't we just leave it as is? I don't think so, because there have been 5 other states in which ACLU offices have challenged these laws against an interpretation that photographing one's ballot was a violation, like an election violation of these laws. So this is a real interpretation. I think the fact that this hasn't been a problem in Alaska is a direct result of the Division of Elections' perfectly reasonable interpretation that this should not be enforced against people photographing their own ballot. And the other aspect of this is obviously that one has a free speech right to take a photo of their own ballot. And this is something that is known in legal terminage as a core political speech. It is one of the most protected rights that we have. And so this sort of ties into Representative Birch's suggestions that maybe we need tighter laws on photographs of people going in and out of the ballot place. For right now, those are completely legal. The only restriction that we have on photographs in a ballot place is actually in a voting place is actually just the ballot itself. And if you were to restrict what a photograph could contain, that is constitutionally problematic and would be considered presumptively invalid because it is a content-based restriction. So if you can control what speech people make, that is will almost assuredly be a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech. Certainly time, place, and manner restrictions can be implemented, but those are also subject to a lesser degree of scrutiny, but a court will review those to make sure that they're consistent with the First Amendment. And then finally, I think this isn't just necessarily about an issue of voter confusion. There is also legal vulnerability. So in the future, this were interpreted to involve ballot selfies, to prohibit someone's photograph of their own ballot, that would be, a legal liability for the Division of Elections.
Thank you, Ms. Rich. And are there any questions for Ms. Tara Rich?
Excellent.
Thank you again for your testimony. Compliments to Representative Birch. And back to the legislation at hand, is there further... Oh, excuse me. Is there any testimony in the room? There is. And would you introduce yourself and state your affiliation, if any, for the record, and present your testimony?
Yes. So my name is Tasha Elzada. I live in House District 33, and I'm here representing myself and to express my support in some to House Bill 7. So in learning about this bill, personally, I am actually 17 years old, so I'm a high schooler and unfortunately unable to vote as of now, but within 2 or 3 months I will be able to vote. And I don't think, and I personally would love to be able to commemorate that moment of first voting, because I am kind of a political nerd, quite honestly, by taking a ballot selfie. And although it does seem like a small issue, I personally think that it's all about being able to express my First Amendment rights, while also creating a more civically engaged community through social media, especially amongst teenagers. Like I said earlier, I am a high school student. I'm a senior at Junior Douglas High School, and I did talk about this bill with the two government classes taught by Gary Langhart, if any of you are familiar with that name. And it seemed like the vast majority of the students that I spoke to, so about 40 or so students, all supported the bill because of the same reasons that I talked about earlier. Being able to express yourself and talk about or engage more teenagers in the political process. So basically, in some, like, I heard a lot of legal issues, and I think that this is a great way to clarify in a statute that was put in for good reason to prevent ballot buying and to prevent voter intimidation. But our times have changed, and I think that most people who do choose to take a selfie with their ballot choose to do so because they want to express their love for voting or to even express your support for a candidate, not necessarily to intimidate other people to vote for that candidate. And so basically, I definitely think that this is a great way to clarify that this current statute, and I throw my full support behind it.
Thank you, Ms. Elizardi. And a question from Representative Birch.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for some of the most articulate, well-spoken, and well-presented testimony that I've heard in some time. And for someone who is 17 years old and soon to vote, I commend you on your efforts to become prepared, and thank you for your position. I think it's an excellent point. I have, the grandchildren in my life are not, getting the cameras and doing the selfies, and I think your point is very well taken. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Elizardi. And is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 7? And seeing none, and with no one else on the line, I'm closing public testimony, which brings us back to the bill at hand. And I didn't believe I saw anyone making an indication they had further comment or question.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck, please.
Thank you. And actually, the testimony from ACLU also clarified something with me. And she was using the term voter's own ballot. And when we look at the sections of the bill, they talk about the voter's marked ballot in line 11 on page 1. And looking at page 5 above that, the voter's ballot again. So your recommendation earlier does keep consistent if we were to change line 12 of the amendment to voter's marked ballot. But I'm not going to take that up at this moment right now, but it would make it consistent. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
All right, and we will follow up on that duly. Teamwork makes the legislative dream work. This is great. great piece of legislation in the next committee referral. Any other comments on the legislation in front of us? And is there a motion?
Yes, I move House Bill 7 from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And the question before the committee is whether to move House Bill 7. Is there any objection? Hearing none, House Bill 7 moves from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note, and we'll take it at ease to do the paperwork. House Bill 7 passed out of committee, circling back to House Bill 31. And is the sponsor available for questions? And I should note, in a perfect world all equal, I am motivated to move this out of committee today, but also want to allow time for questions and all sort of angles to be explored. So we can see how things shake out. Representative Johnson, I believe when we paused, you had a few questions. Do you still have questions?
Well, this is a thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we spent about an hour on ballot selfies, certainly I would think this issue would be, yeah, this one, we want equal time.
So, obviously, I'm very much want to make sure that justice is done, and my first thought on this was, you know, especially, you know, 18 months seemed like a long time. I mean, especially if that meant that justice wasn't happening within 18 months and so on. But after some further thought and examination, I have a number of questions. And I guess, first of all, I was wondering, if I may, I have several questions. One is, how is a, you know, not a rape kit, but some other type of DNA is evidence? Is that, if no one's been charged, what happens with that DNA evidence?
Mr. Chairman, apologies for my absence at the beginning of the meeting, and really appreciate the flexibility of the committee to switch the order so I could get myself in this chair. So that's my first comment, so I really appreciate that. And through the chair to Representative Johnson, I could not answer for every other type of crime, but evidence collected is the property of law enforcement, and my understanding is that it's, you know, always remains the property of law enforcement until such time as it's destroyed or, you know, otherwise, for example, if something's confiscated. In fact, I think the chair has had a bill on this, forfeiture and seizure of property, for example. If something is resolved favorably for the individual who was originally arrested for that crime, then, you know, making sure that they would get those possessions or property back. And so I wouldn't want to speak for, you know, other categories of crime. That's my understanding. And I believe that is a national standard, though. And in Alaska, we have the Alaska Police Standards Council, who, you know, develops our own statewide standard. And if that's something that's really important, what I would want to do is just consult with them to make sure I have accurate information.
Follow up?
Yes. So my concern is on privacy, because the intent of the bill, as I was reading it, is once the evidence is collected, it's under the control of law enforcement agency that's investigating the accident or the incident. SA kits are treated as evidence. They're in the physical custody of the law enforcement agency. I guess, So an incident happens, the rape kit's collected, and either the charges are dropped or no one's charged. So now we've collected evidence, there's no crimes been committed, but the bill has a fiscal note to track that DNA, keep that DNA evidence, and to track it. And I guess that's the part that concerns me. I mean, I'm all for catching criminals and prosecuting them to the fullest extent of the law, but when it's collecting and tracking, keeping someone's DNA on file for who knows how long into the future, but it's never been charged with a crime, I have concerns about that, and so I just would like you to speak to that.
Thank you, and through the chair, Representative Johnson, I appreciate you bringing up the privacy concerns, because we've also talked about the privacy of the victim in that particular circumstance, and there's a few different ways that might happen. So an individual might be sexually assaulted, raped, and they go and have the rape kit, but as the gentleman from Department of Public Safety, I apologize that I don't have his name in my mind at this moment, spoke to the other day, oftentimes it's a known perpetrator in that particular circumstance. And so that part of the reason why they weren't doing testing on every case was those kind of events. But now what they've learned is that they shouldn't think about it in it being an isolated case, even if that person was known to that individual, because they're finding out that these individuals are involved in other crimes. And so from the law enforcement perspective, you know, that makes that evidence so valuable. I think that indicates sort of in balancing those different needs in that scenario, you know, choosing the public safety need over the privacy need of the person who committed the crime. And that would be where the person is a known assailant. So there's no discrepancy about whether a crime was committed or not. but the kit wasn't tested because that person was known. That would be different than a circumstance, and in that first scenario, charges would be pressed. It's just that the kit would not be essential to you know, for the prosecution to make a case because the individual's already the known perpetrator. There could also be a circumstance where an individual chooses not to press charges, and it sounds to me like that's more the circumstance that you're concerned about, where an individual chooses not to press charges, but then, you know, what would happen with that evidence? Because then, you know, essentially, you know, does a person have a right for that evidence to not be used in a way that would incriminate them in another crime if they weren't pressing charges for this crime? But as I understand it, with DNA collection, because it's standard now for DNA collection to happen, you know, with many crimes, you know, that I guess has been resolved in a way that, again, you know, the public safety need has been the first priority.
Follow up? Obviously, no, thank you, through the chair. Obviously, there's no question if there's been a crime committed. There's no question if someone's charged and may have their DNA tested, and maybe they're exonerated, maybe they're, you know, go further with it. But if they're never charged, but they've had the evidence collected, there's a fiscal note on this, and the fiscal note is specifically to track these DNA kits, and it's not to catch up with a backlog or to make sure that victims have more justice. It's the tracking that the fiscal note is for. And I think in these times, if we have to be aware that this isn't something that's going to make it more likely that someone is going to have justice in this case. It's going to be that they're going to be evidence. I mean, personal information is going to be tracked.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's a good point. And one of the challenges in the system right now is because no tracking is done, it's impossible to know sort of, you know, where a kit might be in the process, who's actually in possession of it, because no one's tracking it. So the main purpose I see and the greatest value I see is to make sure that something isn't lost in the process, because with the challenges we have in rural communities, when we worked on the original bill, it was pretty startling to kind of hear the number of opportunities there would be for miscollection of evidence or lost evidence, frankly, because in some cases, for example, if a community doesn't even have a BPSO and you're relying on a trooper and a trooper can't get there immediately, there are time limits to when this collection can actually take place that would even make the evidence usable in any way, because biological evidence is not good forever. And so, you know, there are these circumstances that are really, I think, in some ways unique to Alaska because of our geography and our limited access between communities. But what I would hope is that by using that tracking system, you know, we might be able to have higher level of confidence that there's not sort of a problem, if you will, in the way kits are being sent out and what's coming back. But really the only way to answer that question would be to put a system like this in place. And so you'd be tracking something through the system, and you'd be able to benchmark that against what we know has been happening now and historically. And that would give you a way to compare the two to see what the problem was. And if that's something we need to, you know, look into more and talk to the individual, you know, at the crime lab or at the Department of Public Safety, I'd be, you know, very willing to sit down and spend some time, you know, with you to work that through. It reminds me, for example, of us talking about the prescription drug monitoring database. A lot of concerns about that. And so generally people, you know, have concerns about what kind of personal information is available in a database and if that information could be used in a way that, you know, harms another individual wrongly. So I really share that concern of yours, and hadn't really considered that in this particular scenario, but I do think there's a lot of value in making sure that we feel comfortable that wouldn't happen.
And before you go on, Representative Johnson, there's a number of other questions from the committee, and we're also 5 minutes away from adjournment when the Finance Subcommittee starts, and public testimony is still open. So what I was going to suggest is we can hold on to this bill for now, and we've noticed bills previously heard for next week, and hopefully continue this good dialogue. And what I'd like to do is Representative Birch, offer you an opportunity to ask any further questions of Keely Olson, who we ended with last week. She's with STAR. And if so, I think we've got a few minutes for that. And if not, I can close public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to thank you for the questions that were and the responses that we got. That had answered most of the questions as far as the backlog. And as we were looking at this earlier, Crime Lab is under two kits, the oldest being October of 16, which doesn't sound like it's really that, that far back. However, it has a statement here that says internal review indicates that they're kits that were never submitted to the lab go back as far as the mid-80s, and it doesn't have a number there. So I guess my question would be, how big a room full of kits are we looking at? What kind of a backlog is that? How valuable is that? Mm-hmm. And to the point of Representative Johnson had, it indicates that, as you mentioned, that the evidence is under the control of law enforcement after it's collected. Mm-hmm. And I think I presume the justification there is that if there's a serial situation that they've got a long-term record there. Mm-hmm. My question is, what is the backlog? I mean, is a number? Is it 500, 50, 1,000? I don't see that number on here.
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Birch, the backlog that we found out from the audit is 3,600.
3,600.
Those are the ones that actually haven't been sent to the lab. And that's the confusion. Those other numbers are ones that have been sent to the lab and their status there. And so you can see, the difference between the two, which I think actually lends itself nicely to the questions about the database of the challenges of this whole, there's just no chain of command from the start, of where that kit originates and its life cycle. And that's what a database would allow, be a life cycle tracking of that kit. What we know now is when a kit is sent to the lab, right, that's the information we can provide, right, when it was received and where it's at in processing. But it's the discrepancy between those two things, which at this time the number is 3,600, that is, I think, the most concern for a lot of individuals of where they are and why they've been languishing. And again, back to the comments from the department, that now what they're learning is, you don't want to, even if you had that from 10 years ago and didn't test it at the time because it was a known perpetrator, and so it wasn't necessary for that particular case, now because the understanding is such that individual may likely be involved in other criminal behavior, now it is worth testing that because, like the article in your bill packet, that individual was crimes in 2001, crimes in 2005, and it was the arrest from the spree in 2014 that actually was able to link them back to those earlier crimes and that earlier collected DNA evidence. And so if that evidence hadn't been collected and kept, it wouldn't have been as meaningful it wouldn't have meant anything at all, right, because you'd only have what happened in 2014. So hopefully that kind of connects those pieces.
Great. Thank you.
And to wrap things up, I'm going to return to Ms. Olson. And Ms. Olson, if you can hear us, you were, I think, midstream and expressing some closing thoughts in response to questions from Representative Birch, and you have maybe 1 minute to sort of close us out today, and at which point we'll be able to close public testimony. And please go ahead if you have any further comments, not that you're obligated to.
Yes, this is Kimmy Olson representing STAR, Standing Together Against Rape in Anchorage, and I'm not aware of any ongoing questions that were left hanging from Representative Birch, so if I'm missing something, please let me know. I did want to just quantify that there is the possibility that someone would be able to, in some jurisdictions here in Alaska, be able to undergo a forensic exam but not give their consent to open that up to an investigation. And they're called non-investigative reports, or in Anchorage we call them anonymous victim reports. And a victim of a sexual assault in those cases is not giving consent in any way for those kits to be tested. Now, they may choose to at any time, and the idea behind it is to provide more options and areas to reporting for anyone who is nervous about coming forward so that they have more options. It is actually a requirement under the Violence Against Women Act, under their forensic science, that be done. So we would be very concerned about those kits that are anonymous being tested without the victim's consent.
Any questions for Ms. Olson, Representative Birch?
I'm still challenged by the thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still challenged by the comment that once the sample is taken, it's in law enforcement control, and it's basically can be used down the road. And I'm trying to understand that distinction, and maybe we aren't going to do that here, but it is an open question for me. Thank you.
Ms. Olson, any comment in response to Representative Birch?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Birch, I have been in communication with Representative Tarr today, and she is very open at looking at drafting policies in regards to making sure that those anonymous kits that have not received any consent from the victim to go on for investigation are separated out.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, and that sounds like something that can take us to the next time we hear this bill. Thank you for your testimony, and at this time I'm going to close testimony for House Bill 31, and that will take us to the end of this meeting. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 7th, 3 p.m., again followed by Finance Subcommittee at 4:30. This meeting is adjourned at 4:32.